I hope I will not confuse people, but I want to repeat again a couple of things that I did. Okay? So I want to repeat again some of the things. So TIJ, TIJ is a matrix which is T11, T22, T33, T32, T31, T21, T23, T12, T13. This is equal to 1/3 of T11 plus T22 plus T33. 0, 0, 0, 0. T11 plus T22 plus T33. 0, 0. T11 plus T22 plus T33. Okay? I'm just decomposing the matrix into three terms. This is one of them. Plus, let's write the symmetric traceless, antisymmetric, sorry, 1/2 T, this is T, this is 0, of course, it's antisymmetric. Now this is T12, which is T12 minus T21, and here, T21 minus T12, 0, 0. T13 minus T31, T31 minus T13, T23 minus T32, T23 minus T23 plus T32. Okay? Plus 1/2 of first you have diagonal ones, now it's instead of antisymmetric, symmetric, T12 plus T23, T13 plus T31, T23 plus T32, and here again symmetric, T12 plus plus T21, T13 plus T31, and here T23 plus T32. Of course, this is not a true statement, so this matrix, this part plus this part gives all the off-diagonal elements. The diagonal are wrong, and I have here minus, because I put the 1/2 here, I should put here 2/3 of T11 plus T22 plus T33. And here on the diagonal, I have the same thing. Well, this is obvious, right? I'm just writing a matrix in three blocks. I'm missing something. Huh? Sorry. I need T11 minus this, T22 minus this, and T33 minus this. Right? Now when I sum the three matrices, this stuff here, this is canceling the first term, then it's only remaining the diagonal terms, and this plus this gives the off-diagonal terms. Okay? So now, what? Yes?
So what you wrote on the diagonal is T22
minus... What I wrote on the diagonal? This one here?
Yeah.
Okay, let me write this. T22 minus 2/3 of T11 plus T22 plus T33. And here T33 minus again this stuff. Okay? Now, the claim is, rotate your elements of your tensor, and these matrices here don't mix with each other. Okay? For example, this part here is what's called the trace, which is just sum of TKK. As usual, I'm raising and lowering indices, I don't care. It's absolutely the same thing. Upper and lower, it's the same. TKK, this is the trace. Now, what was TKK? TKK was equal to XK, YK, which is equal to X dot Y, which is equal also to X transpose Y, okay, which transforms into X transpose R transpose R Y, which is equal to X transpose Y, which is T K K. Yes, sum over K. Sorry? Yeah. For me, yes. Yeah, typically they do, yeah. Yeah, two double indices apply even if they are the same. Yeah. Normally you prefer to put one up, one down, yeah? That's what's bugging you? Yeah, you can put. This is also for, I can also raise this one if you prefer. Or consider just explicitly the sum. Or the contraction with delta with an upper index. Yeah. If you really... But it's the same thing. It's Euclidean. Delta is just delta k k prime t k prime k. Okay. So it's obvious that this object transforms into itself. Notice that here I use that t was a product of two vectors, but of course it's not important. The only thing which is important is that the first index of t transforms with an R matrix, the second index of t with another R matrix, and R transpose R being equal to the identity is the only thing which is being used. It's not really crucial, if you think a bit, that t is a product of two vectors. What's important is that the first index of t transforms with one R, the second index of t transforms with another R, and we are only using that R transpose R is equal to identity. Okay? What about, so this, I make a rotation, this matrix stays as it is. So there is a trivial representation, if you want, if you think of, let me act on the space of these diagonal matrices, then there is a trivial representation. It is just the identity matrix, which just acts here to give always the same element. So there exists a trivial representation which acts on these guys and just gives again themselves. So it's a 1. So the tensor product, there is a, in the 3 times 3, there is this 1, which I showed you. What about the anti-symmetric part? So first let's do it in the... First we can do it in the more pedestrian way. And we can just see that rotations preserve the symmetric and the anti-symmetric parts. Okay? So suppose I have some Tij which is anti-symmetric. In other words, let me write Tij like this to be 1/2 of Tij minus Tji. It's the definition. Then this Tij transforms into R. Now it's useful to put the indices in the in some position where the formulas look nice. So Tij is transformed into R. I, R, J, I prime, J prime. This is how each index is transformed. And then T, I, J. I prime, J prime. Good. I prime, J prime. Now, because these two indices are anti-symmetric, and I'm multiplying by some matrix, I can anti-symmetrize this matrix. Because if I write this as symmetric plus anti-symmetric, the symmetric times the anti-symmetric gives 0. Right? So I can anti-symmetrize this matrix. So this is equal to R I prime J prime I J T I prime J prime. And now this object is anti-symmetric in I and J, not I prime J prime. You can easily see if you write one of the elements of this object. And therefore, sorry? This notation here? Okay, so this means R, can you still read if I write here? R I prime R J J prime minus R I J prime R J I prime over 2. Okay? So this is again a tensor, the product of these two. I'm just anti-symmetrizing two of the indices. And now it's clear that because this is anti-symmetrized, this anti-symmetry property is also true for the IJs, right? Because if I would do it for the IJs, I would write exactly the same thing, right? If I would do it for the IJs, this is what I would write. I would just write these two factors maybe in opposite order. So this is also antisymmetric in I and J. So it means that it's still antisymmetric in the I's and the J's, and therefore this object transforms into themselves. So there are matrices which keep these objects of the same form. Okay? So far, I can put my elements of T. This is one element. Then the other three elements are these ones. And then the other five elements are these ones here. So let me see in another color. So this is one element of T. This element transforms into itself. These three elements transform into themselves. And these five elements transform into themselves. Five, right? Five because it's traceless. So this is the sum of these other three. So let me consider like this. Okay? They are not independent. One of them is the sum of the other three. This is why it was traceless. Now, it's clear from the argument I wrote there that the symmetric and anti-symmetric parts don't mix. I could use exactly the same argument for the symmetric, and I would get the same. So it's clear that if I represent my vector first the symmetric and then the anti-symmetric, it's clear that my big rotation, if I split the symmetric and anti-symmetric, my D big, it's clear that it's equal to a 3x3 block and then a 6x6 block. Right? This would be the symmetric part, and this would be the anti-symmetric part. Now, this is just because of this kind of arguments, right? That the symmetric and anti-symmetric don't mix. What we are seeing also is that inside the symmetric part, there is a block which is irreducible, which is the trace. So what we saw by that is that this 6x6 block is actually a 1x1 block, and then we just proved this, and therefore what's left is the 5x5 block. Okay? This 1x1, 0, 0, 5x5. This is what we have seen, because we have seen that in the symmetric, furthermore, I can still reduce more, I can still consider the trace component, which is a particular element in the symmetric elements, and that one doesn't mix with the other symmetric elements. Right? So when I act on my symmetric elements, they don't mix among themselves. So let me summarize. Finally, this vector T, a useful way of writing it, of writing this vector T, is as T11 plus T22 plus T33 over 3, if you want, this doesn't matter. Then this is the first element of T. I rotate my vector T and this component never changes. Then T12 minus T21 over 2, T13 minus T31 over 2, and T23 minus T32 over 2. These are the other three components that don't change. And then the remaining 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which are the symmetric traceless. Okay? And the other 5 elements. And they don't mix when I rotate, which basically means that 3 times 3 is 1 plus 3 plus 5. So my rotation matrix, naively, if I choose my vector T11, T12, etc., up to T33, and then my vector rotates with some d big, naively, no, this is what it is. It's equal to some matrix where all elements are non-zero. But actually, we have just seen that this is equal to S, a change of basis, times a representation which is 1x1, 3x3, 5x5, times S minus 1. So even though, so the naive one looks like it is not, like everyone is non-trivial, but actually we showed that it's possible to choose a smarter basis so that the effective representation splits into smaller representations. Each of these blocks is obviously a representation, because when I multiply them, each block is multiplied by, when I compose D and D and D prime, the block here becomes block D times block D prime, so it must itself be the block D of G times G prime, so it is a representation. Okay, is it now clear? Okay. Yes, no?
I have a question. Uh-huh. Usually if you have a representation on a vector space, mm-hmm. V1 and another representation.
Sorry?
There was the dot. On a vector space V1, uh-huh. And another one on a vector space for V2,
yes.
You can glue them together with a tensor product, so you
it's
get
what it is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So, because I didn't quite follow the path 3 times 3, what do you mean by that? Do you like have two
I have two vector spaces of dimension 3. I multiply, I tensor them together.
Yeah.
Naively, I get a vector space of dimension 9.
Yeah.
But that vector space of dimension 9 contains invariant vector spaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
Such that when I act with my representations on those invariant vector spaces, the elements don't leave the vector spaces.
Decompose it to a direct sum.
A direct sum. Exactly.
But I mean, where did you get that 3 times 3 thing from?
3 times 3 was the segment that I start with two vectors, with two spaces of dimension 3. I have a tensor with two indices.
Okay.
Right? 3 times 3 is because I have two indices. 3 times 3. So what we saw is that we have the index, like here you probably cannot read. You have the first index, the second index, so you get 9. But 9, we saw, was the direct sum of 1 plus 3 plus 5.
But I mean, have you on the left-hand side,
yes.
Have you like glued together two representations? Or
we have glued together two representations. You saw? This representation here is always this representation, the product of two representations. Right? So I'm gluing together two representations, creating in this way a bigger one. In other words, I know how an index transforms. And now I have an object with many indices, I have to rotate all of them. Right? And this is how, from one representation of one index, I get a bigger one. But now this bigger one lives in a bigger subspace, a bigger vector space of dimension 9 in this case, which decomposes into smaller vector spaces which don't mix among each other when I apply them rotation matrices. Okay. Any other questions? No? Is it clear? Yes? Uh-huh. Yes?
Lower indices. If you put the commutator on the top indices as well as on the lower indices, what would that mean?
It would give the same result in that case. Because if you try to think what it amounts to anti-symmetrize the upper ones, you would write exactly the same expression. It amounts to writing these two terms and then exchanging the two R's. Right?
They're not really commutators.
Yeah, I know. I just didn't know what else to call.
You think you put here the commutator in I and J, means that you write this expression minus the same thing with I and J exchanged. But this is exactly this second one. So this is already anti-symmetrized in the upper indices. Okay. So, what else can I say about this? So let's see. Okay, so it's clear that it's split into 1 plus 3 plus 5. They don't mix. Very good. So now let's consider particular examples. Let's go back to these unitary groups and let's consider U1. Okay, you remember U's were were defined by the fundamental representation, it's called. And and let's consider what U1 is. Or maybe just one more thing about this stuff that some people were confused. Is it clear to everyone that R transpose R equal to 1 is equivalent to the statement that delta ij is invariant? Or should I do it? Is it obvious? Yeah? Should I do this or not? No? No? Okay. I feel guilty if I don't. Sorry. So I have some delta j here. Let me write this, make this in components. What does it mean, this? This means R transpose IK R KJ equal to this. This is this equation in components. This is nothing but, okay, this is nothing but R KI, this is the transpose. And contracting these indices, I can contract them to a delta with a delta function. So this is nothing but delta I prime J prime R I prime I R J prime J equal to delta I J. And this is the condition that that delta is invariant. Okay. Good. So another thing which I forgot to say is that when we defined SON and SUN, we used faithful representations to define them. And the name of this representation is the vector representation. In the case for SON, we chose n matrices of size n by n, so clearly they act on spacetime vectors and rotate them. And it's called the fundamental representation for SUN, so which are the representations of size n of SUN. Okay. Another thing that I wanted to say about these antisymmetric tensors was that each component of the antisymmetric tensor had this geometrical meaning of being the Wettach product between X and Y, and therefore they rotate. This is another way of saying that they must rotate among themselves. Okay? Of course, we saw it in the direct way, but there is this more geometrical way of saying it. Okay. So let's consider U1. SU1 is nothing. Let's consider U1. So U1 is the set of matrices U, which are 1 times 1, so they are numbers, such that U dagger U equal to the identity. In other words, we have U, that doesn't make sense, which belongs to C. It's a complex matrix. And U must be a phase. Right? And then by U dagger, we just mean U complex conjugate is equal to e to the minus I phi. And of course, U star U is equal to 1. Okay? So U is just a phase. It's a bit hot here, isn't it? Sorry. Okay. Good. Okay. So this is a representation, right? I wrote here U. If you want to use the notation in the notation of representations, we would say that we have an element D, which is parametrized in this case just by an angle phi, which is e to the I phi. And if I have D to the phi 1 times D to the phi 2, this is just an exponential with a d of phi 1 plus phi 2. Okay? This is just an exponential with the sum of phases. And of course, phi belongs from 0 to 2 pi. So this reminds us the kind of multiplication. So you see that from this representation, I can make my multiplication table for this group. And I put here some phi 1, some phi 2, and I get here phi 1 plus phi 2. Okay? So I start again from the fundamental representation, and I go from the representation to the more abstract multiplication table. Now, this multiplication table should remind you something. Forget about U1. What would this represent? What other group would you say admits this representation?
Phi
this multiplication table. What other group is multiplied in this way? It's a billion, right? As well. Phi 2 with phi 1 gives phi 1 plus phi 2 again.
SO2.
Sorry?
SO2. SO2.
This is exactly what we get when we have SO2. Exactly the same, right? There's no difference. We multiply just these elements, and rotations in the plane are just given by an angle, and they are just rotated. So this is the first of many equalities that we will write during these first three lectures between groups, which is that SO2 is the same as U1. Okay? How can we see this in maybe an even more explicit way? Let's start with a vector representation. Let's start with SO2. And let's try to understand why it is the same. All right, we already understood, but again, we start with SO2, and our rotation matrices are parameterized just by an angle, and they are cosine phi, sine phi, minus sine phi, cosine phi. Now, this is a two-dimensional representation, right? This matrix, x on the vectors, x and y, to give new vectors, x prime and y prime. Let's change bases. So let's change bases to x plus I y and x prime and x minus I y. So let's choose these bases instead of the bases x and y. How does this matrix look like in these bases? Can someone tell me? How does this matrix look like in these bases? D of phi, now x on x plus iy, x minus iy, to give the new x plus iy and the new x prime minus iy. And what is this d phi? Let's put d prime, the new one, which is of course equivalent to the previous one because it's a change of variable. There is some change of variable s with some 1/2 and stuff. D of phi s minus 1. And this is just the matrix e to the I phi, e to the minus I phi, 0, 0. Okay? So again, the representation was decomposable, and we got here two one-dimensional irreducible representations. D of phi and the conjugate representation D star of phi. So indeed we saw explicitly that we can think of rotation in the plane, we can choose these bases, and then all we need is a phase, which is of course absolutely obvious because both to parameterize both of them we just need an angle. Right? So we just need an angle to parameterize an element of U1. We just need an angle to parameterize a rotation. Right? So in both cases, we just need an angle. Okay? So how can I, in the same way that I said that SO3, I can think of a vector whose magnitude and direction give me the angle and the axis of rotation, Where is the useful space to parameterize the elements of U1 or of SO2? It's a segment of line between 0 and 2 pi, or in other words, it's a circle, right? So elements of SO2, which is equal to U1, live in a circle. So the group SO2 is equal to the circle. It's a set of elements, and I can think of each element as a point in the circle. Okay? So we can write the relation, each element is a point in the circle. So we can write our first relation involving spheres, which is that SO2 is equal to U1, which is nothing but the circle, S1. Okay? This is the one-dimensional sphere. Circle or one-dimensional sphere. Okay. I think this is clear, right? Each element of SO2 is parameterized by an angle, which is a point in the circle. What about SU2? Throughout these lectures, I will write many, many boxes like this and explore many, many relations between different groups and different manifolds. What about SU2? So, is this clear? Yeah? SU2 now. Now, SU2, let me remind you, SU2 was equal to the set of 2x2 matrices U, such that U dagger U is equal to the identity. And such matrices can be parameterized by putting the elements inside a matrix N1 plus IN2, N1 minus IN2, N3 plus IN4, I'm just parameterizing the real and the imaginary part of my matrix in this way, minus N3 plus IN4. Okay? This is just a parameterization of the matrix. Okay? This is just a parameterization. Why? I forgot here. Determinant of U equal to 1. Sorry, determinant of U equal to 1, important, yeah, good, thank you. This is just a parameterization of U. But this parameterization has a nice meaning, because when we impose these conditions, they have a nice meaning on these ends here. I think you saw it in Nima's lectures, right? So what is the condition that the determinant of U is equal to 1? So you can check, you can easily see, it's obvious, right? You multiply this one times this one gives n1 plus n2 square. This one times this gives minus n3 square minus n4 square. So the determinant of U, and actually you can check that it's the condition that U belongs to SU2, is equivalent to saying that n square, which is n1 square plus n2 square plus n3 square plus n4 square, is equal to 1. Okay? Yes. No. This is just a parameterization, right? Each element, I'm writing it in this way. And SU2 is equivalent to the condition that the determinant of this matrix is equal to 1. If you have a matrix like this, where the determinant of when n squared is equal to 1, this is an element of SU2. Okay? Are you worried with some sign? You see, you have n1 plus I, let's compute the determinant. n2 times n1 minus in2, it's the determinant of U. Minus, and then I have n3 plus in4 times minus n3 plus in4. This is equal to n squared. Right? No, it should. It is okay, right? Is it not? I just checked here. No? You need this minus because there is a minus when taking the determinant. Very good. So this is something interesting because what is this condition that n squared is equal to 1? It's a definition of a four-dimensional sphere. Three-dimensional sphere. It's a definition of a sphere which lives in R4 and which has n squared equal to 1. So this condition here is the definition of the three sphere, S3. So we see another interesting relation, that SU2 is equal to S3. So the elements of SU2, they have a nice interpretation. Like you can think of them as points in a three sphere. Each point in the three sphere gives a different element of SU2. Yes?
I don't want to be done, but SU2 is a group because you've got a set of points and a composition method.
Yes.
S3 isn't a group, it's a set of points without a composition method, right?
Right. So to two different points in S3, I can map them to two elements in the group. So the equal sign means they are isomorphic.
Okay, so you're saying the set's the same.
The set is the same, and I can compose the points also. I mean, I can associate a rule that to each two points in the sphere, I map a third point. And this is the group composition.
They are equivalent
as
magnitudes.
Huh?
Yeah. So if they want to change the point, I mean, is that three points having some kind of composition? Just the set of points.
Whichever way makes you happier. I can if you want to think as S3 just a set of points, then this equal means just an isomorphism.
Okay.
So each point is another point. You can think of it as a manifold in the sense that the elements have the same topology. These elements here of SU2, you move smoothly in the vectors n, provided n squared is equal to 1. But what is this, moving smoothly in vectors n such that n squared is equal to 1? It's moving in a sphere. Right? So the topology of the sphere is the same as the topology of SU2. Right? I'm sitting in the sphere, moving in my n, so that n squared is always equal to 1. I can think of it as being in the group, being moving in my n, always being in SU2. Okay? You can even make it more rigorous and define a metric in the group and show that the metric is a metric of S3, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm.
You have four ends there, but you say it's the three sphere. Why is that?
Okay, so what would be the two sphere?
Okay.
The two sphere is my three vectors. This is clear, right? What is the circle? Circle is the two ends, right?
Okay, wait.
Circle, okay. S1 is equal to the set of n1 squared plus n2 squared equal to 1, right?
Remember the dimensionality of the surface, not the space it's in.
Oh, yes.
So this is a sphere. It is embedded in four dimensions. It has three dimensions, right? Because I can move. If I am sitting in the North Pole, this N4 is equal to 1, and then I move in the tangent directions, which is N1, N2, and N3, for example. In the same way as if I'm sitting here in the North Pole, I have two directions which are changing n1. At each point, the tangent space is three dimensions. I have four dimensions, I'm called one constraint, I have three dimensions. Whatever way you prefer to think. Yeah? But it's, as you said, it's three dimensional because it's a surface with one condition embedded in four dimensions. Okay? Now, what about SO3? What about SO3? Let's see now. SO3, we might actually also be tempted to identify to be the three sphere. Why? Because each vector, so we have our theta, okay? And we have to choose the direction and the magnitude, right? So we need to choose the direction and the magnitude. But let's write the condition of the fourth sphere in a slightly different way. Let's write the condition of the sphere in the following way. N1 squared plus N2 squared plus N3 squared is equal to 1 minus N4 squared. Okay? Okay? So I think of my fourth sphere in the following way. A fourth sphere, I can think of it as fixing some radius and then giving me a point in the two sphere. Okay? So I'm thinking of S4. So we can think of S4. S3, sorry. Yes. We think of S3 as an S2 with varying radius. Okay? So the radius is this part here, and the S2 would be this condition here. So the right hand side equal to some constant defines an S2 with a given radius. And now a vector n is like telling you, you give me some n, I compute this, and now I have a point, I still have to specify a point in S2. Right? So you give me an N4 plus a point in S2, right? So an N4, plus a point in S2 is equal to a point in S3. You give me N4, this defines the radius, and then I just need to tell you the point in S2. Okay? In other words, you give me an N4 plus a direction in three dimensions, and this is equal to a point in S3. Why a direction? Because a direction defines precisely a point in a two sphere, right? I just choose a direction and this specifies a point in S2. Right? A point in S2 is just a direction in three dimensions. I have a two sphere, right? I have a sphere around me, and if I want to pick a point, I just point in one direction. Right? Is this clear? One direction in three dimensions gives a point in a sphere. But this is interesting, but then we might wonder, why? Wait, can we think of this as the magnitude of theta? Can we think that we are giving a magnitude of theta, a direction, and therefore a point in S3? We might wonder. Okay? If so, this will tell you that SO3 is also equal, because SO3 is given by a magnitude and a direction, is also given by S3. If so, it's not true. But if it was, then it would also be true. What is the subtlety? Okay.
Theta is
cyclic. Here N1 is also between some fixed range, because N4 is also fixed to lie between 0 and 1. So this would be the analog of theta. Sorry, no. Between minus 1 and 1. And you might think that this could be the analog of the magnitude of theta going between 0 and 2 pi. You might ask yourself whether this is true or not, but it looks plausible. Right? So this is not really the obstacle. Yes?
Because you have a minus sign. I mean, you can choose N4 to have a plus or minus sign.
Absolutely. Two N4s which differ by a sign give me the same sphere. Two N4s. I give you two N4s. And this is not the same as choosing a magnitude of theta, because there are two N4s which will give me the same magnitude. Okay? So N4 and minus N4 give the same radius of S2. Okay? This is, in other words, okay, no. And therefore, the correct statement is it's almost true, if it was not for this small detail, that two different N4s give me the same radius of my sphere, and therefore, if I give you a magnitude of theta, I cannot tell if it's N4 or minus N4. So what happens is that SO3 is equal indeed to the free sphere, provided we identify N4 and minus N4. We identify them. Now they become the same point. If you give me an N4, that's equivalent to a minus N4. And this can be written as SO3 is equal to S3 over this identification of these two points. I write it over Z2, which is a relation that some of you might have seen before. Okay? And this is equal to SU2, because SU2 is S3, over Z2. Okay? So Zn Z2 is the group of reflections of two points. This equation means what's written above. Means that it's S3 where we identify the two points which are related by a reflection. This is what this slash this division means. Sorry? No. I don't think so. But let's discuss it a bit later. It's really not in the... Good. So... Yeah, is this clear? I think this, I hope this first line at least is clear to everyone, right? So we saw that it's not a point in S3, is almost an element in SO3, not exactly, because two different n's would still give me the same element, so if we identify them, then yes. So an S3 with antipodal points identified in this sense, that N4 and minus N4 identified, is equal to SO3. Okay? One minus n4 square. This n4 square runs between 0 and 1. So this here runs between 0 and 1. Right? So this quantity here is between 0 and 1. So it's a good analog to this theta, which runs between 0 and 2 pi. It's just different choice of units. But an n4 doesn't give me just two different n4s can give me the same magnitude, so it's not enough to decide what it is. Okay. Now, this equation here is a good excuse to introduce a very important notion, the notion of coset, because a way of properly defining what this equation means, I wrote it above that equation, but to formalize it a bit more and to generalize it, it's very important to introduce the notions of coset. So let's speak about cosets. Okay? So to define a coset, we need, the ingredients are the following. So we need a group, G. We need a subgroup, H. Okay? It's a subgroup H inside G. Okay? So the elements of H, So H, the elements of H, let me call them H1 up to HN. If it's continuous, of course, I mean the set of elements of some with some parameter, whatever. Okay? Is this clear? So if I have, okay, I hope. So then, GH, okay, which is called the right coset of H in G, or not the right, but a right coset, because it depends on a particular small g, which is an element. G1, G2, etc. We pick a particular one, and this is very simple. G, H is just the elements which are obtained by G, H1, G composed with H2, G composed with Hn. Okay? Is this definition clear? Is this clear? I have a group, I have a subgroup. The coset is obtained, the coset which, to speak about the coset, I should tell a particular group element of G, I just compose all the elements in the subgroup with that G. Okay. Is this definition clear? Right coset, because I multiplied G with elements of H from the right. Okay? So left coset, so H times G is equal to the left coset, and this would be the elements H1 composed with G, Hn composed with G. Okay? Yes?
Isn't that a bit of a weird way to write it, so that you're referring to H is right?
Rather than our right.
Sorry, Wikipedia defines it the opposite way. I think Jones defines it in this way. I will only use this one. I will only use this one. Do you prefer to call it left? I don't care. Yeah?
Standard Felix.
Good. As I told you, the problem, what I don't like about group theory is all these words, which are just boring definitions, but yeah. But check, I will check in Jones to see if I'm right. Okay, good. It doesn't matter at all. I'm not going to ever use the word left or right for cosets again. I will always mean coset and always mean this one. Now let's understand the following statement. If you give me two cosets of a group, they either coincide or don't overlap at all. Okay? So let's write this statement and understand it. So given two cosets, they either don't overlap or they coincide. Okay? So given, so two cosets, GH and G prime H, there are two possibilities for this list of elements. Either don't overlap, or they are the same, they coincide. Okay? Okay, so I didn't write, I prepared these notes a long time ago and I didn't write why this is true, so let me think. So, why is this true? One second. So, let me, let this be the cause of GH. Okay. And the set of elements G times H, and this would be the full group G, right? This is a subset of the elements of G times H. No, actually, I remember. I did prepare. So let me just see what's the best way of seeing this. So, great, yeah. So first of all, let's first consider H only. And inside H, there is the identity. Why? It's a subgroup, so it must contain the identity, right? So the identity is inside H, because H is a subgroup, so it's a group. So it contains the identity element. Okay, so the identity is inside this picture here. Let me consider now some element G here. Okay? Now, when I multiply the elements of H by the elements of G, this blob moves somewhere else. Okay? So I have still the identity here. Okay? And now G times H is somewhere here. Of course, it contains the element G, because G times identity is G. Okay? So there's where the coset is. Okay? Now, let's consider another element here, an element G prime. Okay? Now, there are two possibilities. Is G prime equal to G times some H? For some element H inside capital H. Okay. This is one possibility. The second possibility is that G prime is not related to G by applying an element of H. Okay, so either G and G prime are related by acting with an element of H, or they are not. Yeah? Either yes or no. So let's suppose that they are related by an element of H. If they are related by an element of H, okay, if you have here G prime, then if they are related by an element of H, then then GH is also equal to G prime H. And if they are not, so this would be case one, and if they are not, the claim is that then G prime H is completely disjoint from this case. Give me just 1 second to clean the argument. So the argument is FG, yeah. If G prime is G times H, then let me see. G prime equals G times H. Yes?
If G prime is in GH, then G prime times some element in H is equal to G times some element in H, because if you write it down, G of G prime.
So what do you say? That G prime H in case 1 is equal to G times H times H1, H times H2, sorry, G, etc. Okay? But H times H1 is some element in H, because it's a group, H1 prime. This is some element in H, H2 prime, etc. So H prime, G prime H, if G prime is equal to G times H, is indeed of the form of the original coset, where I multiply G by the elements which are in H. Okay? Yeah? Is it clear? And this list contains all the elements of H. Right? Yes? Is it clear? So if what are you asking? I'm using one, yeah. In case one, so let me repeat again here. In case one, G and G prime are related. So G prime is equal to G times some H. So G prime H is equal to the elements G, H, H1, G, H, H2, G, H, H3, etc. But H, H1 is just another element in H, H1 prime, another element in H, H2 prime, another element in H, H3 prime, which are, of course, the same elements, which, of course, span all the elements in H. Okay? Ah, okay, yes. If you want. I would not call it a theorem. I think it's more or less, I think it's obvious to call it a theorem. But, okay, yes. But I'm using the fact that when I multiply by, when I multiply H by all elements, H1 up to Hn, I get the same set. I get the same H1 up to Hn rearranged, just. Okay, because each element here, if you want, I can write it as H minus 1 times another element of H.
Is this true for, H can't be infinite?
Okay, good. So let's assume that the group is either finite or compact, which means that it's either finite or that I can consider it as a limit of a compact group. But in practice, it's true always.
What's a compact group?
Compact group. It's a group such that the manifold of the group, which is the set of points which parameterize the group, is a compact manifold. For example, SU2 is a compact group because to parameterize SU2, we only needed points in a sphere, and the sphere is a compact manifold. It's not, yeah. So the parameters which parameterize it live in some finite region. Say an angle which ranges between 0 and 2 pi. Or a couple of angles which parameterize directions. And they are finite. What? How can you imagine a non-compact group? For example, Lorentz. Lorentz, you have a boost, and the parameter that you boost can run from minus infinity to infinity. It's not, it is not a finite manifold. Okay? But for now, for very long, we will only start discussing non-compact groups in the last two lectures. But up to there, we will always consider compact groups. Okay? Okay, and exactly the same argument, if it is not of this form, then it means, by definition, that G times the identity is not, that none of the elements is related by by an action of H. Okay. Actually, yeah. In my notes, this was to be left as an exercise. I'm not sure if this will be used later, but I think it will. Good. Now, no, it will. Yeah, it will. It's quite important. Okay, good. So, any doubts here? Any question? No? So So notice that when the cosets don't intersect, it means that there is no way of writing g times h as g prime times h prime. Right? Because they don't intersect. But this is equivalent to saying, it's equivalent to saying that g is not related to h. Right? Yeah? If they don't intersect, it means that there is no h and h prime such that, so the picture that they don't intersect, just to finish the proof, the picture that they don't intersect means that so we saw that the picture where they are coincident, where they are at the same point, where gh equal to g prime h, means that g is equal to g prime times some h. Okay? Which is obvious. I have an element here and an element here, and they are related by definition by some h. Okay? So now, and if they are related by some h, I can. Okay, this means that g and g prime are related by some h. The second case, where they don't overlap at all, means that here you have gh, and here you have g prime h. So that means that there does not exist any h and h prime, such that g times h is equal to g prime h prime. But this is, of course, equivalent, multiplying by h, that to saying that it does not exist any h, such that g is equal to g prime times h. I just multiplied by h minus 1, if you got h prime prime, where this guy is h prime times h minus 1. There is an inverse always. And therefore, these two cases, which of course are obviously disjoint and cover all possibilities, are equivalent to either overlapping or not overlapping at all. Okay? So we see that if we have a group, then we have a space of cosets. Right? So here are possible cosets. Okay? For each G, we get a coset. For different Gs, we might get the same coset, right? We might have some G gives this coset. Some other G prime gives this coset. Some other G prime prime might give the same coset as before, etc. So there are, of course, less cosets than elements of G. Right? And now there is a very important notion, which is the notion of coset space. Coset space is equal to the space of cosets. Right? I have my cosets. Here is the space of all possible cosets. And the coset space is the space of cosets. No, the space of all possible cosets in G. Okay? The space of cosets in G. Okay? The coset space for a given H, the cosets that I use using a given H. For a given H, are the space of cosets in G using H. But of course, all possible Gs. And this is denoted by G divided by H. Okay? So G divided by H is the coset space, the space of all possible cosets that we can get by picking elements of G and dividing them by H. In other words, and this is the important way of thinking about them, the coset space defines an equivalence class. So the coset space is the space of elements of elements G which are not related by H. Right? You have many elements G. All of them which are related by H, you group them together. This is just one element. Right? So you have many, many different G's. If they are related by H, one single element. Another single element. So this would be G's which are related by H. If they are related by multiplication by H, as we saw, they define the same coset. So this is G's, again, which are related by H. But between these two cosets, they are not related by H. This is what we saw here. There are either one possibility. Either they are related and then they define the same coset, or they are not related and they define two different cosets. Right? So you pick all your elements of your group, group them according whether they are or are not related by acting with another subgroup, and this defines, now you have just two elements, and your coset space are, as in this picture, two elements. And this is what is called the coset space. Okay, and now the previous expression makes sense. Now S3 over Z2, or SU2 over Z2, was the set of elements of the three sphere, right, which are not related by H. If they are related by H, they should be identified and they are the same point. So if they are related by N4 and minus N4, then they are the same point. They don't count as two points. So we cut the space in two, and this was what gave us SO3. So SO3 was obtained by picking SU2 and identifying points and cutting SU2 in half. Or cutting the sphere in half by identifying N4 and minus N4. Yeah?
When you say space, is it a vector space?
Vector space? No, it's not a vector space. I cannot sum elements of a group. No. No. It's a space of elements in the same... What is SO3? It's a space inside, it's a space of... Each element on that space is a vector with a magnitude and a direction, right? You should think of it abstractly. Each element in that space is an instruction on how to realize an operation, how to do a rotation. Each element is a rotation. You cannot sum rotations. Uh-huh.
So there you have two spaces which are related by H in themselves and the space surrounding.
These elements here, all these elements are related by H. And therefore... They define the same coset, right? And this coset is one point in my coset space, because coset space is the space of cosets. So each coset counts as a point. In other words, points which are related by H don't count as multiple points. They count just as one single point.
No.
Yes. So I introduced this notation. This, I'm always speaking about this one, whatever this one is, I don't know. Huh? Very good. So, yeah, okay, good. So I could say what a normal subgroup is, but we will get there. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Is one example of a coset is also good? That's not always the case.
That's not always the case. A coset is not always the case. This is related to Eduardo's question. No, a coset defines a space. A priori, if the original space is a group, it's not obvious that the coset space is a group. Okay? So the coset space does not need to be a group. We will see tomorrow what are the conditions on the coset on the subgroup H so that the coset space is a group. So to practice, it might be useful to consider one more example, right? So what example could we try? What kind of groups and subgroups do we know? What do you propose to consider as an example to construct a coset and try to see if we understand what it is? Good. Good. So let's consider G to be three-dimensional rotations. This is the example we know the best. We already saw it once today. And H to be two-dimensional rotations. What is this coset? Okay? What did we discuss? Now, there are several ways of doing it. Let me do it, for example, recalling you what are Euler angles, which you probably learned in mechanics. Okay? Any rotation in three dimension can be decomposed as a sequence of three rotations with Euler angles psi, theta, and phi. And this works also. So any rotation, any 3D rotation, can be decomposed as, and this is simple enough so that you can convince yourself just by thinking in three dimensions, and I will draw a picture soon, as a rotation along Z with phi, which follows a rotation along the axis X with theta, and then a rotation with angle Z of phi. Okay. So let's see what this means in a picture. So this is any 3D rotation can be written in this form. Let's see that it's true. Let's convince ourselves that this is true. So let's see. So we first do a rotation RZ with an angle phi. Well, now this will be a really hard picture to draw. Let's see. Okay? These are our original axes. X, Y, and Z. Okay? And we decide to do a rotation with an angle phi. So we do a rotation with an angle phi, then we go here. Here. This is the new axis, X prime. This is phi. This is the new axis, Y prime. Okay? This is the first rotation. And this is the axis Z prime, which is not touched. Now, I do a rotation along X by an angle theta. Now, X is this line here now, not this one. X was rotated. So now, I do a rotation along this axis here. So let me maybe draw it in another picture, otherwise soon it will be absolutely impossible to understand. So let's rotate that by theta. So this means that we have this picture. We have this line, which is X prime. And now we rotate this by theta. Let me maybe erase the lines that you should not see. Okay. And let me use the same colors as before. So this is the axis X prime. This was the previous axis before rotating X. This was an angle phi. Okay. This here was the axis Y prime. Before rotating, here it was. It was the axis Y. And here, this was the axis Z. The axis Z prime was at the same position. Right? But now I rotated, so I changed. So let me use another color. Now I lifted. This angle here by which I lifted is theta, right? I rotate along this axis by theta. So this axis Y is now here. This is the new axis Y prime prime. The axis X now is not touched, so this is also X prime prime. And the new axis Z is now pointing in this direction. This is the axis Z prime prime. Z prime prime. Okay? So I rotated first by an angle phi, then by an angle X. And now I rotate by an angle along Z again. So the final picture is I have an angle phi here, an angle theta here, and this defines my x prime. This is y prime. This is z prime 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 prime. And then I further rotate in this plane by an angle psi, so that my final axes are this one, this one, and this one. Okay? So these are the three angles which parameterize any rotation. First this, then this, and then again in this plane, this one here. Okay? And you can easily see that this is how people do in design when they work with solids. One of the ways they do it is by playing with these angles to rotate all possible solids. Now, what does it mean? So, first of all, is this clear? Did everyone understood what this means? I'm just composing three rotations, and here is the picture that I get. So what could it mean to do SO3 over SO2? So points are identified. G is equivalent, should be identified with G prime, if G is equal to G prime times some H for some H. Okay? Which means that basically I can ignore the first rotation matrix, which is an element of SO2. All elements which differ by a different RZ should be identified. Right? So all elements with different first rotation, by first rotation I mean this one, should be identified. So we can choose one, we can pick a representative of this group, we can pick a representative which would be R when we don't do any the first rotation RZ of phi is set to 1. Okay? So in other words, okay, so this first angle phi is absolutely irrelevant, and I can just set it to 1. So SO3 over SO2 is given the elements of SO3 over SO2 are given by just the two angles psi and theta, by these two rotations, psi and theta. But what are these psi and theta? What are these two angles? When we rotate a bit psi and then a bit theta, they are just the angles which parameterize a point in what space? Just these two angles? In S2. So giving me a point in S2 is absolutely equivalent to giving me an element in SO3 over SO2. The elements of SO3 over SO2 are points in S2. Yeah? They are given just by these two angles, as you usually parameterize a point in S2, right? We have the azimuthal angle and whatever the other one is called, polar angle or whatever. Right? We have just this and then how much we rotate. So these two angles are precisely giving us a point in S2. So we find another relation which deserves another box, which is that SO3 over SO2 defines a space. It doesn't need to be a group, and it is not a group, but it's a nice space. It's a two-sphere. So we already saw the one sphere, the two-sphere, and the three-sphere appearing in today's groups. So another relation which deserves to be boxed is that the space, which is SO3 over SO2, is the two-sphere. I should define it as a slash to indicate that it is, I think of it as really dividing, because it's this over dividing, provided they are equivalent, but I do it as a slash because the right and left causes will be different. So I could use some other symbol to denote the other one. Yes? Very good. So let's see. This is exactly what I have here in the notes. This can be easily generalized. That's exactly what I wrote next. Good. So let's generalize. So let me first summarize maybe what have we seen so far. What kind of relations have we saw so far? So we saw this one. We saw that U1 was the one sphere, and it was also equal to SO2. We saw that the three sphere was equal to SU2. We saw that SU2 was almost equal to SO3, but the correct relation was that we had to consider the coset by this cyclic group, and then indeed it's SO3. And I think this was all the relations we have seen so far today. Am I forgetting some? S1, S3, S2. I think this is it. Okay. Now, did we really need to do all these pictures with Euler angles to understand this? No, we did not. What is a sphere in two dimensions? What is an S2? How can I parametrize an S2? I can parametrize in the following way. I say, let me start with a point in the North Pole. And then, okay, let me erase, and I think I should write some things. So let me start with a point in the North Pole. So let's think of the sphere as starting with a point on the North Pole and applying a transformation so that this point, the sphere is rotated, and this point goes to some other point. So let's think of S2. We start from some point in the North Pole. Okay? And then we apply some SO3 rotation. And the SO3 rotation maps this point to some other point. Okay? I do a rotation of three dimensions, and it maps this point into some other point. So can I associate one point in the sphere with one SO3 rotation? Can I associate one point in the sphere with one SO3? Can I associate one SO3 rotation with a point in the sphere? Yes. Right? If you give me one SO3 rotation, I apply it, I see where the North Pole goes, and I give you... So, of course, an element in SO3 gives us a point. Here is the point. But the converse is not true. Why? Sorry? Why is that true? And the different ways, how are the different ways related? You are precise, Trevor, right? You are exactly right. So the reason is because there are more rotations which bring me to the same point. But these rotations, what relates these rotations? How can you imagine a rotation which clearly gives me the same thing? What I can do is, exactly, before rotating, I can make a rotation which leaves this point invariant. And then I apply a rotation. Right? So if we start by doing a rotation which leaves the point invariant, then of course it's the same as not doing anything. So we get the same point if we start by doing, if we start by a rotation which leaves a point invariant. Right? Because then I start with my North Pole, I apply my transformation, I go back, the North Pole is mapped to the North Pole. Right? And then the North Pole went to the North Pole, and then I apply my transformation. Okay? But this is, of course, the same as going directly to my point. Okay? So the sphere S2 is equal to what are called, to what is called the SO3, which are which is called the isometry group of the sphere, over the isotropy group of the sphere, which is the group which leaves the North Pole invariant. But what is the group of rotations which leave the North Pole invariant? SO2 rotations in the plane. Those are the rotations which don't touch the North Pole. So this is precisely SO2. And here I wrote it as a fraction, but of course it's in the obvious, in the previous sense. So you see, without doing any computation, we conclude that S2 is SO3 over SO2. Right? Now the generalization is clear. Suppose I want a sphere in higher dimensions. What changes? I can even use a different color and just replace here 2 by n. Can I use this? Can I do this? Or it's extremely awful for you who have to write everything again? Or can you also use a different color and go through the previous? Is it okay if I just modify? It's fine? Good. I can just use SON. What are the symmetries of this SON sphere? They are the rotations in n-dimensional space. An element of SON gives us a point in the SN sphere. SN plus 1, sorry, yeah. In two-dimensional sphere, it's rotations in the space where they are embedded, which is one dimension higher. Again, an element in SON plus 1 gives us an element. So here, we just put SN, SN plus 1, and SN. Okay? So another relation which deserves to be boxed, which is that the sphere of n dimensions is the coset between two groups, the group SON plus 1 and the group SON. Okay, good. But then, since it's so easy to generalize, let's consider a slightly generalization of, can I erase this? So, since it's so easy to generalize, let's consider a slight generalization of SON, where we introduce a couple of minus signs. Okay? So tell me when I can erase. So let's, the SON was the group such that, again, such that R times R transpose was equal to the identity. So SON was defined as the set of R matrices, which are n by n real matrices, such that R transpose R is equal to the identity, and determinant of R is equal to 1. Okay? Now, let's write this relation in the following way. We want R transpose times 1, 1, 1, n times times R equal to 1, 1, n times. Okay? And with this condition, we saw a relation between n, between the spheres, which have the property that we have this condition times n equal to 1. Okay? So this was related to, in that trivial way, to this set here, which defines the sphere as n minus 1. Okay? So it seems tempting to try to pick these signs and try to find the groups which differ by chess playing with changing a few signs here. For example, a very important spacetime, presumably maybe the most important spacetime, I don't know, is the so-called Ante de Sitter spacetime, which is an extremely important spacetime for any string theorist and not only. It's a spacetime with constant negative curvature, which is just an hyperboloid. And it appeared everywhere in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence, a gauge gravity duality. It's a very important spacetime. The ADS, an hyperboloid, which you can think as a pseudosphere, Xn, is just defined in exactly the same way as the set of n's, such that, but there are a couple of different signs, a couple of different wrong signs, if you want. Minus n3 squared, minus n4 squared, etc., minus n. Ah, okay. I was wondering why did I choose x? Because now I have n plus 1 squared equal to 1. Okay. So the suggestion is to change this n to x. It's of course. Okay, should I do it? Is it obvious that this n is different? Okay, this n here is special. This n is this one. The other n is the definition. It's the vector. Okay? So, for example, ADS2 is equal to the condition that n1 squared plus n2 squared equal to minus n3 squared equal to 1. Right? So what is this? So this is n1 squared plus n2 squared equal to 1 plus n3 squared. Right? So for a given n3, this is just a circle. So when n3 is equal to 0, this is a circle of radius. When n3 is equal to 0, this is a circle of what radius? 1. And when n3 increases, the radius increases. So this is what it looks like. Okay? So this here would be the directions x1, x2, and here x3. And of course, x is the good notation instead of n. Okay? Okay, let me n1, n2, and n3. Okay? This is an example of a non-compact space-time. Good. And now, and you can easily check exactly in the same way as we studied the spheres, the claim is the following. We can define now a more general orthogonal group where we put n, m, which are the set of matrices R such that R transpose eta R equal to eta, determinant of R equal to 1, where eta is the matrix which is diagonal with elements 1, 1, etc., 1, n times, but then minus 1, minus 1, m times. Okay, it's a generalization, where instead of considering just the identity, we put now a couple of minus signs. Okay? And then, the generalization of this expression for n to the Sitter space, and again it deserves a box, is ADS n is equal to SO2, comma, n plus 1 over SO2, comma, n. No, this is not true. This is way too big. So there is a minus 2 missing here. Let me see. Let me put a box and then fix it. I should do the opposite. So if it was a sphere, let's see. So I just add it here. So n, and this is n, so I have 2 minus 2. OK. OK? And for example, this is not something extremely fancy. SO1, 3 is a group that you know. What group is SO1, 3? It's the group of R's which preserve R, Minkowski metric times R equal the Minkowski metric. So they preserve the Minkowski metric. So they preserve the relativistic inner product and not the Euclidean inner product. Right? So this is the elements R which preserve x dot eta dot y, which is equal to x mu y nu eta mu nu. So this is the Lorentz group. Eta is a diagonal matrix with these elements. Diag means, okay, eta. Eta is the matrix which has 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. The number of minus 1 is m, the number of 1s is n. Okay? Yes?
Shouldn't it be
ADS
n plus
1? Let me see. So n, when n is 4 here, I have here SO4. So when I have 6 here, oh, it's a lot, yeah, n plus 2. Yeah, thank you, sorry, yeah. So when I have n equals 2, I should have the n log of 4, which is 2 plus 2. Good, thank you. So this is the only example we have seen, this SON, n of a non-compact group. So this is a non-compact group, which is not surprising. We computed a ratio and it was still non-compact, it was ADS, right? So this ratio is bigger than this one, and it's still an hyperboloid, so it's non-compact, right? So we picked the group, we quotient by something, so it became smaller, and it's still non-compact. So of course, this is a non-compact group, and the sphere is a compact group. It's parametrized just by a finite set of angles. So apart from SON, M with M different than 0, all other groups we saw were compact. Okay. So I think it's enough for today. Is there any question specially concerning the boxes on the left? Or any question in general?
Yeah?
Adam.
Okay. So I'm a bit confused because any three-dimensional rotation you want to do, you don't need three Euler angles to do them. You just need two in the first place.
No. If you want to do a three-dimensional rotation, you cannot do it by just two Euler angles.
No.
No, I cannot.
Because I can get this like this by rotating like that and that, or I can rotate it like that and that.
But then you are not choosing the... when I say by a sequence of Euler rotations, I mean first a rotation in along the z-axis, then a rotation on the x-axis, and then a rotation along the z-axis. If you, of course, any rotation is a rotation along some z-axis, then you only need one angle. Well, the point of the Euler angle is specifying some that you any rotation, you specify some axis, and first you do a rotation along z, rotation along x, rotation along z. Of course, any rotation is just one rotation with some axis of rotation and some angle. You don't need. No? Am I not understanding your question?
I think you do. But I think
so. You don't agree?
I don't. It seems to me that you can get an object into any orientation with just two rotations.
You can get an object into a vector into any other vector by just one rotation.
Yes, but I mean, if you choose just two directions around which you rotate it, you should be able to get it into any
you can try out. Yeah. We can discuss it. I can give you an example where you cannot.
Okay.
Can you
yes. Yes. Of the law, yes.
So
you can. Yes.
So I didn't get. Is SO n plus 1 over SO n, is it always a group?
No, it's not a group. No, it's not a group. It's almost never a group. Sometimes it is. For example, okay, another relation which is quite cool, maybe we should write it, is, for example, this. SU2 is a group, right? SU2 is a group. So a relation which is a group is the particular case of this one when I put n equals 3. So I get a nice relation that SO4 over SO3 is equal to SU2. For example, in this case it's a group, but in general, no. It is a space, it's a manifold, but not always a group. Right? That relation was a particular case of combining this one with this. Okay? More questions? Yes? This is a definition. So the group SON, N is defined by the set of N by N matrices R such that R transpose times eta times R is equal to eta. Okay? In other words, it's equivalent to the transformations on vectors. So this is equivalent to the transformations on of vectors x and y such that the inner product x and y defined as x mu y mu eta mu nu is preserved. In particular, if you choose the eta mu nu to be the Minkowski metric, you get the Lorentz group, right? The group of transformations, boosts, rotations, etc., which preserve the relativistic inner product. Yeah? More? Yes?
So you said you had the Euler angles and then you said Rz phi equal to 1?
Yeah, so when I. This was just an even more explicit way of seeing that that the ratio between these two groups was a sphere. So what we did was we said that any rotation I can think of it as first a rotation in z, then in x, and then in z again. But then, if elements which differ by a rotation in Z are to be identified, then I can set the first rotation to 1. Because any rotation that I start, I am supposed to identify them, to identify all these elements. So to pick one representative means don't rotate at all to start with, for example. Or rotate with a given angle. But then this just amounts to describing the two spheres in a slightly different coordinates. Right? Uh-huh. More. No? Was this familiar to most of you? Was most of this familiar? No? Okay, good. Was it too fast? I'm not going to give you service anymore. I think I already fine-tuned my speed. The last ones were very stable around 2, so I hope. Maybe now I change subject group theory and I should give them again because it maybe it's a harder subject.
The first part was a little slower, but the second part was better. I think it was good.
It was not. It was too slow the first time.
I don't think it was too slow. I think it was
really good. You give this one every day.
Constant feedback is better.
Yeah, that's right. But then I have to think of them every night. Okay, very good. Okay, see you tomorrow. Tomorrow, Monday, right?